Chapter 8 From the Forges of Lemnos. Katie was still dying when I make it to the Victor's Lounge, an hour or so before dawn. Aurelia let me go early, which is one of the few good things I can say about the rest of the night. Nobody notices when I elbow my way into the lounge, and I have to weave through a few Victors, who don't usually come down here. Some people are on the couches, but most of them crowd in front of the screen. "Stay in the back, Finnick. You're tall enough to see over everyone's heads anyway," Johanna says. She elbows me to the side, or tries, but I stand firm. The cameras zoom in on Cato, and I wish they hadn't. I wouldn't have known he was Cato to look at him. I wouldn't have known he was anyone, or anything. The mutts have peeled away his armor and most of his skin it was supposed to protect. Both of his legs are whittled down. They must not have had much armor in the first place. And his head lolls into his chest, twitching, and staring emptily at what's left of him. How he's still conscious at all disturbs me, almost as much as how he's still alive at all. The mutts make a game of it, circling him, slinking forward and crawling back, and when his eyes unfocus, even more, they rip a chunk of flesh away. Blood dribbles out of his mouth, but no sound. Cecilia turns away and sits slowly, one hand to the side of her face, one over her mouth. I glance at Johanna. Her mouth is in a tense sneer. Whoever brought that armor for him is probably shitting himself about now. Just like them, set up a feast and turn the gift around.
She should have finished him off, Gloss says, his lips thin. It would have been cleaner.
She's not going down there with the mutt still fucking around, Haymitch says. My girl wasn't born yesterday.
And this is all for us, Chaff adds under his breath. It ain't for Katniss.
The camera isn't listening to Chaff either. It doesn't leave Cato and the mutts, and the commentary never shifts. I don't know what's worse, listening to how excited the commentators are, after every bite and every tear, or turning the sound off and just watching him die, or turning the television off altogether and missing it. I can't tell how long it's been before Johanna says, "Are they going to make us watch this all night? I'm going to bed. Call me whenever he bites it." She yawns, but her jaw's too tight for it to look real.
"We could all use the rest," Cecilia says and follows her out. Enough of the others trickle out after her, alone or in pairs, making us promise to wake them up if something changes. I could almost laugh. I don't. Even Haymitch gets up and goes. He claps a hand on my shoulder on the way out.
"They do something more than sit on the cornucopia and neck. You give me a call."
Chaff laughs.
"Getting sick of that, too?"
"You bet your ass.
Hell, I bet it's worse when you've got to follow one of them home. I knew both their folks growing up. Can't wait to see the looks they'll give me for letting their kids hit the pay-per-view."
He's grinning, but it's as jagged as Johanna's and as tired as mine.
"Come by later if you get bored,"
he adds to Chaff.
"Might," Chaff says. "Get some sleep. You earned it."
Haymitch nods. He doesn't look like this is the first time he's ever been guaranteed a win. That's probably because he hasn't. Once Haymitch has left, I ask Chaff,
"How much longer do you think it'll take?"
Sooner or later he'll go into shock if he's lost this much blood. He's probably not coming out of it. Chaff shakes his head, sighs, low and rattling.
"Long as it takes for his heart to stop. We've had them slip away before, this close to the end. They'll make her do it, or they'll make us wait."
"Will that be exciting enough?" I ask, toneless.
"It will be if Peeta is dying, too."
The cameras are generous enough to show Katniss and Peeta in the upper right-hand corner, jackets around each other's shoulders, huddled close against the cold. The color slips more and more from Peeta's cheeks, but he points at the moon, marks the passage of time to Katniss in whispers that sound dangerously like death rattles. She nods, shivering, her head listing onto her chest.
"Even if he makes it out, he's losing that leg,"
Chaff says.
"Like your hand?" I say and pause. I can't keep looking at the screen, not now.
"How'd you lose it?"
"Crushed by a mutt," he says.
I managed to kill the thing, but once it stopped bleeding, it left me with a hell of a set of brass knuckles. I stabbed a kid's eyes out, and I swear I felt just as bad. And I wanted to win, so I raced the clock. But didn't you want your hand back? I say. Kato whimpers, high and trembling. The sound seems too young for him. But I never asked Brutus how old he was, did I? It's impossible to tell now. Chaff shakes his head, tips back in his chair. His eyes haven't left the screen yet. They shine with hazy reflections.
I didn't. And I didn't want them to give me a new one. I bought my life with that hand. Anything more than that, I'd owed the capital.
I nod. My head doesn't quite come back up.
That's the thing, when our people win, he says. The ones who ain't careers, the dark horses, the ones who sneak up on you. We don't win because we've trained. We don't win because they wanted us to on the outside. We win because we try. Because we get lucky once we're in there. You and Brutus and them. You went in with some idea of what you were. Beatty, Johanna, hell, even Haymitch himself. You all went in there. And you at least had a strategy, something you could do when the camera wasn't on you. But the rest of us go in with one thing to do, and that's survive. We don't make it out without leaving something behind.
I close my eyes, and of course I see Annie, one of her bad nights, when she's curled in on herself, her hands clamped over her ears, and no matter how much I coax and stroke her hair and kiss her, she won't look at me. I wonder what she'll lose, I say, but I think I know the answer.
Up to her, Chaff says, and leaves it at that.
The moon above the arena shines. I watch it for any shift in its light, but I think it's only wavering because my eyes keep sliding shut. I can't remember the last time I slept for longer than an hour or so, I realize. I should do something about that. Wake me up in the morning, I say. Stretch across Haymitch's couch and tune out the howls of the mutts enough that I can drift off to sleep. Either Chaff doesn't turn the sound off, or the arena somehow moved into my head, or all the way to District 4. Those mutts stalk along the beach by Victor's Wharf, toe at the sand, leave paw prints that the tide doesn't erode. They don't hurt me when I come to them, just pounce on my legs and yap like regular dogs. A couple of them hang off my arms. One paws at my back. I laugh. One hangs shyly off to the side, looks up at me with big, green, O'Dare eyes. I count them. 13. Maeve, Jamie, Katie, Lucy, Helen and Rourke, bigger than the rest, hanging back, Timothy and Patrick, just starting to look more like brothers, less like twins, Lindsay, Laura, Aiden and Connor. Connor's eyes still bug out like a squid's. Something bites my shoulder. I wrench it loose, spring from the couch and drive my shoulder into Haymitch's midsection, it turns out. And he lets out one of the most ridiculous belches I've ever heard. He wrings out his hand. I guess nothing actually bit me, just his grip. Then he says, clear as day, "Fuck you. Ow. Get off my couch." "I'm off," I say, and suit the action to word. "What's happening?"
"It's going to be a big, big, big day," he chirps,
with a better capital accent than I thought he could imitate.
"Nothing yet, just morning."
I don't know whether to be relieved or not. I don't know whether it's relevant, because I'm not going back to sleep now, no matter what time it is or what's happening. I stretch my arms over my head, inch closer to the screen. Streaks of dawn creep over the sky and wash the cornucopia in pale yellow and pink. Peeta nudges Katniss awake and releases her from his jacket.
"It can't be morning already," Johanna complains from the door.
She bats at the tangled frizz around her head, over her eyes, but gives up soon after. I bet I don't look much better.
"Morning comes earlier than this in 11," Chaff says, though the skin under his eyes is even darker than usual.
"Yeah, it lasts 6 whole months back home," she scowls. "How are the lovebirds?"
shaking off their little wings and snapping for worms.
Hamish says, his eyes never leaving the screen.
Yeah, I think she's going for her last arrow.
The clouds in Johanna's eyes clear.
Shit! Everyone's going to be pissed that they slept through this.
They won't for long, Hamish says. That cannon's going to go off loud as a rocket.
They'll pipe it up through the speakers. Just you watch. Nice little alarm clock for us.
Katniss crawls to the lip of the cornucopia, Peeta holding her steady. Her hands tremble, but when Cato looks up at her and croaks through his tattered throat, her aim's true enough. The arrow takes him straight through his skull, and sure enough, his cannon fires from all the speakers in the training center. That brings the rest of the mentors running. By the time everyone else gets here, I can't tell who's commenting on screen or off, let alone whether they've announced a winner, or two winners. Katniss and Peeta make their way off the cornucopia now that the mutts are gone, and start clearing a path so the helicopter can take away what's left of Cato.
I guess this is where I start betting, Chap jokes. How many kids is Hamish going to take home? Two, one, or none?
If you're starting a pool now, you're an idiot, Gloss says.
He has to take someone home, and the boy's already half dead. And Abaria says, a fool's bet. They might still let them both live, Meadow shrugs. Or at least long enough to leave the arena. Peeta's leg is going to catch up with him.
If they manage to put Hamish back together, they can fix his leg, Cedar says, but worries the corner of her lip.
I don't want to wait around for him to bleed to death.
Johanna crosses her arms.
Come on, make the fucking announcement.
Cashmere shoots Johanna a glare that could curdle coffee, even without milk.
I don't. I know what she means.
They're going to drag this out, I say.
They want everyone in the capital, everyone in the districts, awake to see this.
I sit down on the couch again. Hamish shoves me off. I don't think anyone's congratulated him yet, but I'm not sure I want to be the first.
Claudius Templesmith's voice crackles over the television, and we all fall silent. All of Panem must fall silent.
Greetings to the final contestants of the 74th Hunger Games. The earlier revision has been revoked. Closer examination of the rulebook has disclosed that only one winner may be allowed. Good luck, and may the odds be ever in your favor.
Peeta and Katniss stare at each other. Every shred of hope falls away from their faces like sweat.
Well, we knew it, Johanna says. It's strangely toothless for her, like the venom's been drained out.
Congratulations to us, I guess.
The sponsors aren't going to like this, I say.
Fuck the sponsors, Cashmere snipes.
Oh, wait.
I'm not in the mood for this.
Glass houses, Cashmere.
Let he who is without sin, she says, and rolls her eyes toward Brutus.
How does that rulebook look now?
It's not in the rulebook,
Brutus says evenly.
Cashmere's lips draw tight.
Funny, weren't you saying there was nothing in the rules against it?
I was, and there's nothing in the rules for it either. It doesn't say there can be only one, it just says there has to be a victor, or will be a victor. But it never says just one victor.
Semantics, Gloss snaps, his hand on his sister's shoulder. Tell me, Brutus, have you ever had an original thought in your life?
And Abaria smiles, the points of her teeth glinting dangerously.
Have you ever had a thought your sister hadn't had first? She asks, moving to stand behind Brutus.
Wow, you'd think you losers hadn't gotten enough action in the arena, Johanna drawls with a simpering smile.
Oh, wait.
Big talk, Johanna.
And Obaria's smirk widens. Hasn't that big mouth gotten you into trouble before?
Johanna flings herself at Anobaria, her hands tented into claws. I barely have the space to grab her and hold her back.
About the only thing that saves us both is that she's half my size.
Let go of me, Finnick. If that bitch wants a fight, I'll give her a fight.
She doesn't,
Brutus says, with Enobari and a half Nelson.
Not here. This isn't the place.
Meta throws up her hands.
It's never the place, Brutus. You'll never get to fight again. That's your problem, isn't it?
I didn't start this.
Yeah, so let her finish it.
What was that, Meadow? Cecilia snaps. The last thing we need is a bunch of peacekeepers charging in to break us up.
Meadow spits. I think that is exactly what we need if these assholes can't behave themselves.
Oh, hell no,
Chaff shouts, shoving himself out of his chair and straight into Meadow's path. Cedar puts out an arm to hold him back.
We can take care of our own, she says, probably as much to him as to Meadow.
Yeah, and I'll take care of her if she threatens to drop that on us.
He stays where he is, but that doesn't spare Meadow anything.
You have no idea what you just said.
Maybe I do, she retorts, her eyes sparking.
Bet you do, all cozy and fed in 10. Bet them peacekeepers pull a bullet through any cow you choose if you just get on your knees first.
Chaff,
shut up, I say.
I keep holding Johanna back, though I'm not sure as to why now. She looks at me as if to say, we both go after him, we take him easy. He scowls at me, tense all through his shoulders, elbows stretched like he's still got two fists to fight with.
You don't hold the peacekeepers over anyone's head while I'm in the room.
He's right, Cedar says. Everyone needs to calm down now.
You have no idea why someone might get on their knees, so shut up,
I shout over Cedar's protests. Johanna squirms harder than ever, but I'm holding her back as much for me as for her now.
You don't know...
Kid, I've been alive since your daddy got on his knees. Come on, Finnick. Let her go. I'll give her exactly what she deserves.
I'll punch your teeth out, you fat little shit.
You know, I feel sorry for whatever kid makes it out of there if this is what they have to look forward to.
So what, you'd rather be dead? You saying you want a little help with that?
Try it. Just try it.
Everyone shut the hell up and look at the screen.
If the last one hadn't been BT, I'm not sure any of us would have listened. I've never heard BT shout, but there he is, red in the face, with Wyrus right next to him, and she's probably been pointing at the screen for the past minute and a half. Katniss Everdeen and Peeta Mellark count to three, and shove a handful each of poisonous berries into their mouths. I have no chance to figure out what I just saw, because the blast of the trumpets nearly knocked me off my feet.
Stop! Stop!
Claudius Templesmith shouts. And I've never heard him sound this ragged before, this desperate.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to present the victors of the 74th Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen and Peeta Mellark. I give you the tributes of District 12.
Well, shit.
Haymitch laughs quietly from the couch.
Someone owes me a drink.
After the games, people like to throw around the word unprecedented. It suggests there's something new about all this, and novelty never goes out of fashion in the capital. This time, though, unprecedented is more than just a buzzword. Brutus isn't the only one throwing the rulebook around.
It's an outrage, Corbula says,
and I only know that's what she says because she said it 5 times already, and for the first few her mouth wasn't full.
An absolute outrage. They already had rescinded the rule change. Never mind, I haven't heard anything about refunds. And then they just go and let it stand anyway?
But you couldn't have asked for a better ending,
Hostidius says, and pauses his argument to shout, Bishop to d6! The Avox grips his bishop, staff, and edges forward 3 squares diagonally. It looks like he's trying to cower behind it. But from the hollering and clapping in the gallery, he hasn't managed to hide anything. I look away, pick at a square of marzipan someone set before me. Some things in the capital never change. Corbula scoffs. Of course I could have. One with a real show. That's what I hate about all these non-endings. No show, no fight. They needed the mutts to make that girl kill Cato. She couldn't show a little initiative. Or she was just too busy telling that insipid love story for the cameras. Pawn to E5, she adds, and then takes a long gulp of wine. I'm telling you, Hosi, this is pay-to-view sex, and their lovers' trials are the worst thing ever to happen to the games. Then maybe you shouldn't have hired me, I think, and take a sip of my drink so I don't say it. Hosi's right, Lucilla says, her chin in the air. I never thought the games could be so beautiful. I was at my hairdresser's when Katniss offered those berries to Peeta, and we both clutched each other so desperately I thought I was going to faint. Fine, Ludmilla groans. It was exciting. It was stupid. Bishop takes pawn, Hosidius calls over, and everyone around the table raises a glass to toast. What should the penalty be? With an avox like that, Ludmilla snickers. Send him outside, see if he can cross the boulevard without getting hit. But then we'd have to get up, Hosidius says. Better idea. You over there, and that little pawn too. There's a good girl. Trade clothes now. She must be half his size. I drink, but can't block out his toneless grunts as he tries to struggle into her shift, or the tearing of cloth and laughter from the crowd. My knuckles whiten on the stem of my glass. Fine. If they don't see what Katniss and Peeta have done, all the better for us in the districts. Your move, Corbula, Hosidius says when it's done. Knight to B2, check, Corbula says, while the avoxes move around to comply. Corbula turns to Lucilla and raises her eyebrows. You really enjoy that drivel, don't you? It isn't drivel, Lucilla sniffs. Just because you are incapable of appreciating anything other than brutality. Finnick, darling, tell her how wonderful it was when Claudius declared them both winners. It was, I agree, and Lucilla beams. I don't think anyone in Panem could look away. From watching the train wreck of this year's games, you mean? Corbula sneers. Or maybe the games entirely. Crane's gone, that's for sure. I wouldn't be surprised, but not for the reasons Corbula thinks. I should ask Haymitch what's happened to him, though I can't say I'll be sorry either way. Hosidius shakes his head. They were the most profitable games in years. The most profitable since yours, Finnick, if I'm not mistaken. King to B3. Queen to F3. Check, Corbula says. King takes knight, another penalty, Hosidius says. Give me a minute. Were my games really that profitable? Certainly, Lucilla says. They're generating more revenue every year. Yours are some of the most frequently aired, you know. I need to stop drinking when I don't want to answer people, if I'm going to stagger out of here sober. I grind my teeth instead, hope the twitch in my jaw doesn't show. I'm surprised they haven't gotten tired of me yet. Oh, we could never, Hosidius says. Penalty? Sir Knight, do the Lady Corbula some credit with a demonstration of your fighting skills. Feel free to choose your opponent from any of my captured pieces. He turns to Corbula with a sly smile. Since you didn't get enough action in the games. Oh, ha, she says, but sits back to watch. 5 days until I get to go home. 5 days until Peeta can walk, and Katniss can stand, and they can reunite blissfully on camera, and I can go home. 4 more nights of clients. I've gotten through worse. Even if the Capitol is behaving exactly like the Capitol, I know District 4 is in it for a turning of the tide. The Avoxes trade blows, half-heartedly at first, but Hosidius shouts at them that this is going to at least be until first blood, and they pick up the pace. I take a long drink and close my eyes so I don't have to watch.
Really, Lucilla says, as if we haven't had enough of this already.
Ludmilla snatches a grape from Lucilla's plate and says,
Then give me your seat. I want a better view.
Lucilla shifts over, nestles against my side, and puts her head on my shoulder.
At least you agree with me that the entire thing was romantic.
Well, romance isn't my specialty, I say, and the group bursts into laughter. If only they were Avoxes. But it was moving, I'll admit. I've never thought of the games as a love story before.
That's because it's not supposed to be a love story, Corbula says, just as one Avox knocks the other to the chessboard. It's supposed to punish the districts and entertain the rest of us.
I'd assumed people were entertained if the games made money.
The games made money because of that scam operation with the rule change, Ludmilla says.
Now, it wasn't entirely a scam, Hosidius chuckles. The rule change did go through, though I don't think anyone anticipated that turn of events.
He's more right than he knows. It took all of us in the Victor's Lounge long enough to process what had just happened, partially because we all started shouting again after Claudius Templesmith's announcement. Well, except Haymitch, who was laughing his head off, and Beatty and Wyrus had left the room. Mags wasn't shouting exactly, just holding her head in her hand and sighing something about us ungrateful young people. But it was pretty awful.
I certainly didn't, Lucilla says. It was even better than I anticipated. I mean, it would have been an awful anticlimax if they just let the two of them walk away after Cato died.
They know how to ratchet up the excitement, Ludmilla admits, though from her expression you'd just think she'd swallowed a lemon whole. But if the Quarter Quell is all flaming capes and star-crossed lovers, I doubt I'll be contributing.
Oh, they'll pull out all the stops for that, Corbula says. They have to. The Quells, more than anything, are meant to remind the districts just what they did to us. Anything is better than another tawdry love story. Oh, Hosi, can we tell them to stop fighting over there? I think the Avox is already dead.
I know my next move.
So do I.
Certainly, Hosidius says, and waves a hand called the duel off, even if it's not so much a duel anymore.
Just wait a moment, they'll have to clean the floor.
The victors from the Quells aren't much to look at, though, Lucilla says, nestled against my shoulder. I don't shove her off, but I don't snuggle back much.
Two other Avoxes bear the dead one away. His head lolls in an impossible angle, twisted around too far.
We might need to look at Haymitch again, I say, and tear my eyes away from the corpse before I start wondering who he was. He did just bring two tributes home. No mentor's done that before.
Because of that stupid scam, Ludmilla insists.
Oh, but you haven't done so badly yourself, Finnick. I'm ashamed to say it now, but I never thought much of your chances in the 70th games, but you brought that girl home, didn't you?
Lucilla gives me what she must think is a winning smile, but I only see the unnatural evenness of her teeth.
That was almost as unlikely a win as this was.
No, this one was worse. Is the floor clean yet?
Corbula cranes her neck to see.
Good, bishop takes queen. And someone get some of those nightlock berries for the penalty, because apparently Hosi hasn't seen enough of that.
Excuse me, I say, my smile more a flash of teeth than anything else. I grab a vial of purgatives so they won't see how much my hands are shaking.
The food's too good, Hosidius. I need to make more room for it.
Of course, he says and waves me off. I march through the hall, past the bathroom, and out the door into the afternoon sun. I don't look back. Chapter 9. A Line in the Sand. Cinna's apartment is the messiest I've ever seen it. He's not a messy person, the opposite, really. And I'm sure the workroom would be pristine if I took a look back there. But his living room is in, as my Aunt Ruth would say, a state.
The coffee table has three mostly empty orange juice glasses and several cans of protein shake on it, and a flurry of scraps of fabric spilling off over the edge. The carpet is littered with the edges of thread and the corners of bias tape, and I just sat on a pincushion. It hurt.
"Did a typhoon hit while I was out?" I ask.
"Maybe," Cinna says. He doesn't look up from the jacket he's altering.
"I missed it. I missed a lot of things. But I finished your scarf. Annie's, I mean. It's over there on the wall, the one with the beads and tassels. What time is it?"
"Almost 9.
"Morning or evening?"
"Evening. Cinna, when was the last time you left your apartment?"
"Interview yesterday, I think."
He turns the jacket over and stoops to squint at the hem.
"What day is it?"
I pluck the jacket out of his hand.
"Cinna, take a break."
I don't even know if he's going to wear the damn jacket, he says, swiping for it like a cat with no claws. "Careful with that. It's got a dangling needle.
I've been stuck by worse."
"You sat on a pincushion," he breathes, twice.
"I'm sorry."
"Don't worry about it," I say. He has enough to worry about, from the looks of it.
"You are making alterations?"
He sighs, and now he doesn't have the jacket in hand, he reaches down to the basket beside his seat to pull out a pair of pants in the same dark fabric.
"Have to. They're holding the closing ceremonies earlier than I expected. Peter's already awake, so Portia fit his suit."
I drape the jacket over a nearby chair. Cinna's about to spring up and snatch it back, but I block him.
"How is he?"
"Taking pretty well to the prosthetic. Glad to be alive. Gladder that Katniss is alive, by all reports." I have no idea where Cinna got another needle and thread from. Maybe they were already in the hem. Annie pre-threads her needles, too.
"She's still unconscious."
I nod and fold the jacket over my hands. It's lined with a gently flickering yellow fabric, like a distant lighthouse, but the suit itself is a sturdy, shining black. I can just tell by the thickness of fabric that it's meant to conceal the shape of the body instead of revealing it.
"You're putting them in black?"
"No, gold," he says. "Katniss's dress is in the workroom. It's probably too large. They wanted to augment her bosom, and Haymitch put his foot down, so now I have to shrink it or pat it. It would suit her better, anyway. Not having big breasts, I mean. I'm rambling."
"Yes."
I draw him up from the chair, which is easier than it should be. Has he been eating enough? Probably not. "Come on, take a break, at least for an hour.
You're going to sew through your fingers at this rate."
He laughs, but he doesn't stop sewing, and sits back down. "I did once, on the overlock machine, back in design school. I never went to a class hungover again."
"Good plan. Cinna?"
"Yes."
"Put it down."
"Your powers of persuasion, while admirable, have ceased to work on me," he says, deadpan. I grab the pants and dangle them out of his reach. He strains up out of the chair and actually makes an effort to swipe them back, which means shoving me back and trying to step up on the coffee table, but he slips on the corner. I catch him and pin him to the chair with a kiss, which at least stops him babbling about hems. And it takes a couple more seconds and a few deeper swipes of my tongue for him to start kissing back, but he does, like a drowning man coming up for air. I slide my fingers through his hair and he leans into my hands, draws me down close, and for a while we set everything aside, except the pincushion. I have to kick that aside when I accidentally wind up on top of it again. After, Cinna plucks a loose yellow thread from my hair.
"I need to clean up in here."
"You need to relax," I say. "Or I need someone to help clean up for you." "I can't relax," he says. "Well, any more than I just did. Thanks, but I can't. They've already pushed up the closing ceremony since Vita didn't reject the prosthetic. The head game maker's been fired. Haymitch is just as demanding as he was before, but now he isn't sober, and I have to sit to interviews. I hate interviews. The work should speak for itself. And I haven't even designed all the work. I have to build lines around them. Them, the two of them, the two victors, they're both mine. And Portia is going to be great help, I know, but I'm the one that does the designing. I've always been... Cinna, slow down. Okay, sorry. He sinks back into the couch and finds another loose thread, this time plastered to the sweat on his thigh. He runs it under his thumbnail like flossing teeth. They're asking a lot of questions in the interviews about what it means, about what Katniss did means, he clarifies. And I can only say, you can ask her when she's awake so many times. I'm not supposed to be on camera, Fennec. Not with how much I know. I can't hide it like you all do. Let's hope she can, I say. I'm no expert on Katniss Everdeen, but I didn't see any undying love when she held those berries to the sun, to the cameras, to all of Panem. This is what I think of your games, she said. But a fistful of berries can mean so many things, so many possibilities. Are you kidding? Cinna laughs, bitter and low. She's got less guile than the people who buy your coffee maker. It's a good thing she's got Haymitch. I pause. I can't believe I just said that. I took back most of the awful things I said about Haymitch a few nights ago, Cinna says. But I still stand by that he needs to shower about twice as often as he does, and she'll let me make him some new clothes and drink less. But he's less pleasant when he doesn't drink. No argument there. I stretch, toss the jacket back onto Cinna's lap. How much trouble are you all in? Cinna lowers his voice. A lot. The president himself came to talk to us and the prep teams about how precarious our positions are. He threw around a few if something should happen. At least no one laughed. I don't bother to hide my wince. Neither of them know what they just did, do they? You mean Katniss and Peeta? No. Or if Peeta does, he hasn't shown it. I nod, sink back into the couch. At least I'm not stabbed with anything this time. This is insane, I say. I know I'm one to talk, considering what you've been up to, but... It is, he says. But do you know what? It's right. It's the right time. They're the right kids. He sighs, looks at his hands. I did it. I set her on fire. Congratulations, Cinna Ward. You started a revolution. Not yet, he says, but I provided the spark. I came in through a different bar this time, and I'm not the last one. Johanna's still out, and BT says Wyrus won't be coming. Haymitch wanders in with chaff, bottle in hand like it never left. We're still doing this? He says, showing more teeth than I thought he had. Looks like, chaff says, since this pack of losers all showed up, me included. Well, looks like we've got ourselves a conspiracy. Haymitch shuffles over to a chair by the shelves in the corner, and I swear he does a little dance on the way. So how many of you got state visit this week? Snow visited Bast and me, Cecilia says. Briefly, but he made himself clear. Not us, BT says. But he went to two, oddly enough. Not us either, I say. Unless there's something you haven't told me, Mags? She shakes her head. I was half expecting him to, honestly. But I guess he's busy these days. Well, he came to see us, Cedar says. So she's not on lookout this time. That must be where Johanna is. He didn't mince words, either. And I'd pay to watch the replays of the rigmarole he gave my team, Haymitch says. Hell, I'd sell tickets. I swear he turned colors he can't plant in his garden. What did he say? I ask. After the laundry list of responsibilities we've all got now? Well, he made it plain that everything we do is gonna be his to see. So, We better be all junior peacekeepers helping old ladies into their fancy cars, or else. He snickers. You know how that speech goes. And then he pulled me aside and showed me just what he did to Seneca Crane. Do you have any word on what's going on in the districts? Cecilia asks. Haymitch shakes his head. Not yet. You got anything? Only rumors. Bast got into contact with Wolf. He said the victory celebrations at home turned almost riotous, and that a few more of us are starting to get into the planning. But nothing's been set up as far as I know. I think we're going to try and figure out where to go next. That makes all of us, Cedar says. My husband back in 11, he told me about the new curfews, new peacekeepers shipping in. Can't stop us talking, but they're trying to make it harder to meet. Mags, I say. Anything from back home? All my contacts run in the other direction. Mags smiles and tells me, and I translate for the others. Your cousin Manuel wants to talk to you. So it looks like sparks are starting to fly, I say, and hope Cinna doesn't mind me stealing his turn of phrase. But if you don't mind me asking, where the hell do we go from here? I can't say I've ever been involved in a revolution before. I can't say I've ever thought of being involved in a revolution before a few months ago. Hey! Johanna yells from the door. They're busting up a fight upstairs in Messalina's. Time to split. Goes where it goes, Haymitch says, and shoves out of his chair. Like I said before, do what you can back home, and I'll do anything I can to keep those kids alive. The games haven't changed. Just the arena, I finish for him, and help Mags to her feet before we part ways in the corridor. I kiss her cheek and ask, ready for this? Always, she says, and walks off with Cecilia. I don't know if I am, but I don't know if I was ready for half the things I've been through, or ever could have been ready. And I'm still here. That's something, at least. What's the fight about? I shout at Johanna once I've muscled my way into Messalina's. What else? She sneers. Instant replay. Sometimes I wish she'd shove the berries down her throat just so I didn't have to watch her spit them out 50 times a day. I duck a clumsily thrown bottle and lean in. Preview, do you think? I ask, loud enough for her to hear, but soft enough that no one else should. Let's hope. You want to go somewhere else? Where do you have in mind? Someplace we can dance without dodging bottles. I laugh. Step back a few inches, so the man staggering dangerously close to my feet doesn't fall on them. I thought that was your favorite part. It is when I'm throwing them, she says. Come on, how much more free time do you even have? About 2 hours, I say and sigh. Forget it. I'm just supposed to show up at a party. They'll be too busy talking about the games to notice whether I'm there or not. Good. She leans up close to me, stands on her tiptoes. Looks like someone's finally getting a taste for rebellion. Peeta isn't wearing the jacket. I can picture Cinna backstage prying it off Peeta's shoulders and giving up and saying something about how little he cares that I worked on it for hours. I'd laugh, but then I'd have to explain the joke. On the other side of the stage, Katniss looks younger and smaller than she has since I first saw her, in a flickering gold dress that hides all the fires in a woven to the fabric, like a lantern just about to topple over. Everyone cheers as she throws herself into Peeta's arms and kisses him like she hasn't noticed he's holding himself up on a thin silver cane. Come to think of it, she might not have noticed. But either Haymitch told her what's going on, or she really does need Peeta the way she's showing us all. Up there on that stage, she's a teenager in love, who's proved to the world that her love is worth more to her than death. She played the games, and she changed the rules, and between Cinna's styling and Haymitch's coaching, she's convinced enough of the audience that it's no more than love. She sits close to Peeta, and leans on his shoulder, and watches her own games with the eyes of a stranger. I remember my own games, and how horrified I was, that creature was me,
I remember someone once said that fear made the capital love me even more. Katniss isn't afraid. I wonder if she should be.
You're going to ignore everything I told you about your hair, aren't you?
It's tradition.
Just getting that out of the way, Drusus says and smiles at me, the way that shows he's developing crow's feet. Do whatever you want. I won't be there to stop you.
I solemnly swear not to shave my head, Drew.
If you want to, I won't stop you, he says. However, I will subject you to accelerated growth treatments when you return.
When's that going to be, anyway? I ask.
I haven't heard anything about my schedule for next year.
Neither have I. It's probably under review.
I manage not to roll my eyes, but only barely.
Well, I guess someone will tell me.
I'll be in touch, he says. But if the way you've been loopholing your schedules around says anything, is that you need some time without it. I'll give you a couple weeks before I think of calling, all right?
You're a miracle worker, Drew,
I tell him and kiss him on the cheek.
Then you gave me the best materials a master could work from.
He hugs me back and gives me a gentle push toward the platform.
Go home.
I slump into my seat once the train doors hiss shut behind me. Less than a day until I'm home, until I don't need to smile at any more cameras, or wave at any more reporters, or flatter anyone else who makes my skin crawl. Mags is already sitting cozily in an armchair, eyes closed, a relieved smile on her face.
Not asleep yet? I ask.
Not yet. I've plenty of time to do that on the way. I concede the point.
It's going to be an interesting homecoming.
She glances out the window as the train groans to a start. It is. But for once there'll be something for you to do once you're there.
You're telling me, I say,
and prop my feet on the table next to her, mostly because I can.
What about you?
I will do what I can, she says, and I plan on sleeping in the sunshine.
You know, I say, I think Annie might just join you.
She smiles, drifts off, and neither of us say much for the rest of the trip, but we don't have to. I watch the mountains give way to lower ones, and then rolling green hills, and then, at last, to sand and the cliffs of home. The windows are open so I can smell the ocean drifting in the wind. That never fails to make me smile. Not even when I came home from my own games or from Annie's. I nudge Mags awake and help her out of her chair and down the platform.
We're home, I say.
My family is here. I expect smiles and the sun and the rush of cousins up the stairs grabbing my knees and hands and pulling me and Mags down. And I do hear a couple of them shouting, Finnick! Finnick's home! But that's just Timothy and Patrick. And mostly I just hear the sort of forced hi's and hey's that I used to throw off when I shut myself in my room. I count everyone's faces and only come up with 22. And then I realize that Aunt Ruth is wearing black. I expect the skies to be overcast today. They aren't. They're as bright blue as I've ever seen, and the water sparkles in the clear sunlight. There's enough of a breeze to stir the sails, but not enough to guide them home. So I turn on the motor and take Annie and me back to shore. She curls up at my feet in the shadow of the bench while I work the till. She stayed wrapped in the sheets all morning, dragged them up onto the deck with her and everything. I know I should tell her we have to get dressed for the funeral, but frankly, I don't want to either.
How did it happen? I finally ask. My throat is cracking. From the salt or from something else, I don't know. I just know the burning hasn't stopped yet.
Fire, she whispers. The boat caught fire. Of all the things you'd expect to face out at sea. I nod. I can't bring myself to say anything else just yet. The brown one cuts through the waves easily enough, and the gulls flock toward us when we get nearer to the shore, circle the mast and call. I'm going to have to wear a suit. With a shirt underneath.
The thought almost makes me smile, but I remember Uncle Jonas ribbing me about my fashion choices in the capital, and I can't.
Was it just Uncle Jonas on the boat?
I ask. No, she says, muffled in the sheet. Niall was with him too, but he got away. I was watching. They screamed. She trails off. They screamed at each other, but I couldn't hear the words.
So it wasn't far offshore?
I want to swallow again, but my throat won't let me. Aunt Ruth hasn't said more than two words to me since I stepped off the train. Before I took the boat out with Annie, I saw her sitting at the kitchen table, Aunt Coral's hand on her shoulder, staring through the screen door. Annie leans against my shins. No, not far. Close enough for the tide to bring pieces in. I'm dreading the next question, but I have to ask.
When?
She doesn't answer at first, just tightens up. We're nearing the docks. I'll have to get up soon. But I don't want to pull away any. Don't want to leave her, or the ocean, or anything. 3 days ago, she says, finally, barely louder than the hum of the motor cutting out. The night before the closing ceremonies.
The night of the meeting.
Snow hasn't visited, I said then.
Well, he's left his message loud and clear now, hasn't he?
I asked Mags if she knew something I didn't, I remember. Did she know about this?
No.
No, Uncle Jonas is as good as her nephew. She'd never hide this from me. This is my fault. My hand slips from the till, hangs limp at my side. He as good as warned me, didn't he? And I ignored him like an idiot, like the worst kind of idiot imaginable, because I thought I had something on him. Fire. He's turned our weapon against us. I know he meant that as a message. I draw Bronwyn to the docks, nudge Annie so I can climb out and hitch the boat. She climbs out after me, still wrapped in the sheet, and presses herself against my back. I lean in. I've missed her so much, and right now I don't care who's looking or what they see. I'll walk you home, I say. You're home, she says, but takes my hand anyway, rubs our thumbs together in slow circles. I don't let her hand go, not after we've walked through the door and Dad is holding me tight and Uncle Brian is trying to lead us upstairs so we can get dressed. Not yet, I say, and Annie's thumb nestles against mine. Aunt Sharon is embracing Aunt Ruth more tenderly than I've seen her hug anyone. I wonder if Aunt Sharon's remembering Uncle Douglas and how he dashed his boat against those jetties years ago. You never know what will happen at sea, she whispers, her lips bloodless, her eyes shining. Aunt Ruth shakes her head, and it drifts on the way to hang like her neck can't hold it up anymore.
It wasn't the sea that took him.
Ruth, Aunt Coral whispers, coming over to join them. I'll say it, even if no one else will. She shoves Aunt Sharon off and sits at the table again, pours herself a glass of water. It spills over the edge, and she doesn't seem to notice at all.
It wasn't.
I nod to Annie and cross to the table, rest my hand next to her, lean down to whisper,
"Not here."
I look at the corners of the room and hope she'll follow my gaze.
It's not safe.
Then what is? Aunt Ruth snaps at me, glares over the dark circles under her eyes. What's safe, Finnick? Would you know? Annie squeezes my hand. Her hair tickles my shoulder. Her breath warms my skin. How did I get by so long without her?
I'm sorry, I say.
I can't look at Ruth. The floor is blurring dangerously.
Let's get dressed, Annie.
She nods, and I can't tell which of us is leading the other upstairs. She keeps some of her clothes in my room. Mother says that Annie sleeps here a lot when I'm away. She hasn't been home since Uncle Jonas died, and we put our clothes on in silence. I have trouble buttoning the shirt, and my fingers leave streaks of sweat around the buttons when I slip. Annie helps, but keeps making the buttoning motions with her fingers even after she's done.
I cover her hands, bring her fingertips to my lips.
I never wanted this, I say, and my voice won't hold steady at all. I tried so hard.
Someone knocks.
Finnick, you decent?
It's Rourke.
Yeah, and so is Annie. Come in.
He pushes the door open, steps inside.
My tie's too short, he says. Do you have a spare?
His suit strains at the shoulders. The sleeves stop a half inch short of his wrists. He's almost as tall as I am now, I realize. And he hasn't put on as much muscle as I have, but he's getting there. For a moment, I can't do anything but stare.
You're a kid, I want to tell him.
But he's already too old to be reaped next year. I wonder if my parents feel that way when they look at me. Like I can't have possibly grown so big so soon. Like every time they think they've gotten to know me, I've changed again.
Check my closet, I say.
He nods, pats Annie on the shoulder and makes his way over.
She's right, you know, he says. I mean, Aunt Ruth. You think so?
I keep my voice neutral, though I haven't been very good at it lately.
I'm not the only one who does, he says.
He pulls a red tie off the rack on my door and holds it up to ask for my approval, and I nod.
But it's just thinking. We can't know.
Yes, you can, Annie says. She looks at Rourke, but past him, like she could see into the mirror through his body. I rest my hand on her shoulder, as much to steady myself as anything else.
Don't talk about it, I say, and tap my ear. They're listening. You can't put too much stock in rumors.
If we did, everything would happen because of ghosts, Annie murmurs. Or things that come out of the ocean. Or us. Ghosts. Rourke smiles and finishes knotting his tie.
I know. I shouldn't bring it up.
I like your pin, Annie says. Thanks, he says, and then I finally get a look at it. It's a small gold tie clip I never thought he had. He's wearing a mockingjay. I miss sleeping with Annie curled up against my chest, more than I'll ever let myself admit. Even after all the horrors of today, the funeral, dinner after, listening to Dad and Niall and Brian and Ruth getting drunk, listening to Connor crying and Lucy sniffling and Katie slamming her door. At least I can still lie next to Annie and know that, even if my dreams try and tear me apart, she'll be there when I wake. I bury my face in her hair, kiss the top of her head lightly enough that I won't wake her up. She sighs, shifts against me, but doesn't wake.
I love you, I whisper, even though she doesn't say anything back. The way her arms circle me and her legs twined with mine says, I love you, as clear as anything.
The sun hasn't risen yet, but outside it's gray, lightening every minute. I can't sleep now that I'm awake, but I don't want to move from here, from her, from this. So, of course, the phone rings. The sound cuts through my ears like an arrow through my skin, and I remember it the same way. I wrap a sheet around my waist and run to the downstairs phone because I don't want to wake Annie this early. The phone hasn't stopped ringing by the time I reach it. I didn't expect it would.
Hello?
Good morning, Finnick. The ocean roars in my ears, loud enough that I nearly stagger back.
It's early,
I say, because anything else I can think of might get someone else in my family killed.
Yes, but you weren't asleep, and besides, Finnick, I wanted to speak to you alone. Your family must be exhausted. Grief is always exhausting. My condolences.
How would he know? I doubt he's grieved a day in his life. Not over his enemies, not over Argentia, not over his own daughter.
I'll let them know.
Thank you. Now, with that out of the way, you must imagine I have some concerns.
I do, I say. Dig my nails into my palm to remind myself not to say anything stupid, no matter how much I want to.
I can hear him smiling, can practically smell the blood at the corners of his mouth, now that I know what's hiding it.
In light of your behavior these past games, I will not be calling you back to the capital until the quarter quell. I almost dropped the phone. Thank you, I manage. It's as close to genuine as I'll get with him. I'm glad you appreciate the gesture, Finnick, but I'm afraid once you come back to the capital, it will be a permanent relocation. You have 1 year to remain in District 4. It will be up to you whether your family is still there to see you leave. I don't say anything. I can't. The ocean isn't just in my ears anymore, it's around me, swallowing me, deep and black, and stabbing me through with ice. Don't presume I'm unaware of the sentiments that these past games have aroused in your district. Snow goes on. I do have eyes and ears, you know. When I said I expected a certain standard of behavior from you in the capital, I meant it. And you betrayed my trust. You've paid the price, and you know that I won't hesitate to remind you of that price, just as I remind you of those standards. It's very simple, Finnick. You behave as a victor should, and you'll be rewarded as a victor should be rewarded. Victors never live in the capital permanently, I say. It's all I can think of. It's the only defense I have. I can't think of the rest of it. I can't. He laughs. Victor seemed to be doing things differently of late. I lean against the wall. I have to. I can't breathe. The ocean's crept into my lungs now, and every breath I take is so cold. 1 year, Snow repeats. 1 year to make it clear to me that you know whose country you live in. And I don't have to tell you what will happen if you decide to stand against me. No, I say, numb, and struggle to clarify. You don't. Good. I'm glad we understand each other. He waits. He waits. I can't. I have to. I can't. I won't. I rip the foam from the wall and dash it to the ground. Sparks fly. There's your thank you, Mr. President. There are a bunch of tattered wires in my kitchen and broken plastic on the floor. Smoke curls out of the socket, sour and awful, and drifts toward the screen door. I follow it, and Annie's reflection stares back, hazy in the glass. I turn, leave the kitchen, find her at the bottom of the stairs. She's holding the banister, her knuckles as white as wave caps. It's not over, she says, shaking her head but keeping her eyes on mine. No, I agree. But now we know who the enemy is. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the authors. You can do that at a link to the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening.